Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Robert?
I'm doing well. Today on the show, we have several good things for you. We have a segment with the Reverend Robert Christopher Hughes talking about Reverend William Barber of North Carolina's trip to Louisville. Jasmine's going to talk to us about the Bevin versus Bashir board situation, which is always evolving and always a topic on the show. Jasmine's also going to talk to us about Governor Bevin's pension chat, and we are going to have a segment, a nice long segment, about catching up on several stories that we are tracking as they advance. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and get started. Okay, joining us this week is Chris Hughes. Chris, how are you today?
Doing good, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Chris, he is joining us because he went to go see the Reverend William Barber of North Carolina as he brought his Poor People's Campaign to Louisville. So Dr. Barber, if you may know him, he spoke at the most recent Democratic National Convention and has been touring the country to take his Moral Mondays campaign in North Carolina to a national audience. Chris, you were at the event in Louisville. Talk to us a little bit about it. What was the main message that Dr. Barber brought to town?
I think the main part of his message was, and the thing that he's been sort of working towards for a few years, is that he wants to lift up issues like poverty, like healthcare, racism, voting rights, environmental protections. He wants to lift these up out of the sphere of partisan politics, and he wants to frame these as the moral issues of our time. So that was really the centering point of his message. To him, it's a moral issue that we live in the wealthiest country in the world, but we still have so many people in poverty, that we have such extraordinary healthcare and advanced medicine, but we still have people who are sick and dying because they lack that access.
Right. One of the things that I've seen from Dr. Barber, I've heard him speak once before, is that moral issues for the longest time have been framed along the lines of like abortion and gay marriage and those types of things were, you know, if you heard on cable news, like moral issues, those are what were talked about. And he's trying to move that to something different. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I think he's trying to cross a lot of barriers by reclaiming morality. You know, this crowd that was gathered there is a big mix of people, religious and non-religious, civic leaders, gay, straight, left, right. Well, maybe not so much right,
but
hopefully a good mix. By framing it in terms of morality, he can attract a much bigger swath of people.
So, I mean, and that's kind of interesting to me. That was actually one of the questions I had written down. The religious right, they were really known for bringing in people who are of marginal religiosity, like some people who are not necessarily as religious, and got them to start using religious terms and using religious language to kind of build their audience and to build their platform. Do you think Dr. Barber's doing the same thing? Were there people in this audience who were not religious that were there to see a reverend speak about moral issues?
I can't really speak that they were, you know, explicitly not religious, but it's definitely...
They weren't necessarily, like, their job wasn't like a reverend. They were like civic leaders.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, a lot of those. A surprising amount of, you kind of picked up on this undertone of really wanting to make it a regional movement here, because a lot of the speakers were actually from Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think he's trying to build a broad coalition. He's trying to take this next step to elevate these issues of healthcare, race, voting rights, workers' rights, environmental protections that disproportionately afflict those in poverty.
Okay.
So I just want to add, like, the second part of his message that was really, I thought was really important, was very, very interesting, was in response to Charlottesville. He was really pointing out how a lot of these issues are connected to race. He really made this point that if you look at the wishes of white supremacists and the KKK, and you look at the policies that have been advocated and passed by more conservative leadership, he wanted to show that there's not much that has to be done to draw a connection between that. He said, it's easy to condemn extremist actions, but racism is about policy.
Right. Trying to connect the policy decisions of the Republican people in Congress and in legislative bodies to white supremacy. Interesting. Okay, one of the things I read about the event was that the crowd was small. Is that right? And what do you make of that?
It was a little smaller than I would have expected. I'm very bad at guessing crowds. I would guess that there were about 100 people there. There was a huge gathering when I first got there of clergy up in the chancel, standing up in the chancel, and it was probably at least half of the crowd up there that could fit up there. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. One, I think it was right after, it was 5 o'clock, hard to, for people to get there.
Uh-huh.
Two, I don't know how much promotion was really put into it.
Right.
I just found out because I had a friend who was going on Facebook, and that is why it popped up in my news feed.
Okay.
So,
yeah. So you were actually living in North Carolina when Dr. Barber's Moral Mondays were going on. Talk to us a little bit about that. And do you think you'll be able to replicate that on a national scale?
I'm not sure. I think for me, the Moral Monday movement was one of the biggest surprises of being in North Carolina, having come from Kentucky. You know, it started in response to this ultra conservative leadership coming into power and suddenly enacting all the legislation they ever would have wanted,
mm-hmm.
all at the same time. And so Moral Monday came as a response to that. I feel like when something like that happens in Kentucky, you know, you might have a demonstration or two, you might have 100 people or something show up, but this Moral Monday movement was sustained and persistent, and mm-hmm. it was a big movement of religious leaders and lay people and civic leaders for every Monday of the summer for years. So as far as nationally, that's the part I'm really, really curious about. This has been kind of an evolving movement. He's been going around speaking around the country, and he's been building up this coalition. What I really wasn't clear about coming away from this talk was, is there actually going to be something like a march mm-hmm. that Dr. Martin Luther King led on Washington, D.C.?
Right.
Is there actually going to be some sort of tangible poor people's campaign, or are we merely going around? Well, not merely, but are
right.
are we focusing on going around building up awareness,
yeah.
building up coalitions?
And the last question, but do you feel like that the goal here was to build a poor people's campaign in Kentucky, or to have Kentuckians join a national poor people's campaign?
The second.
Okay.
And I would say the more specific thing was they are going to be leading 40 days of resistance
okay.
against the administration next summer. And so the biggest thing that they were asking for was for people to pledge to be a part of that, to volunteer and to support that.
Gotcha.
And so I am now pledged to engage in acts of civil disobedience.
Oh, man.
In 2018.
Does going on to a podcast count as one of those?
It depends on the podcast.
Yeah, so. All right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Chris. We really appreciate that. And I guess you're going to be hanging out with us for the rest of the show. Good luck. Don't say anything stupid. Okay, Jasmine, talk to us about Governor Bevin and Attorney General Andy Beshear and
okay.
their court cases.
So this is a story that goes back to our very, very first podcast episode, which was a year ago.
A year ago. This is our 1 year anniversary.
It
How
is.
About that?
This is kind of an update on the Bevin versus Beshear court cases. There's been an update in two of them. There are four current lawsuits where the Attorney General has sued Matt Bevin, but there's updates in two of them. The first one is the U of L Board of Trustees. So this case was argued at the Supreme Court of Kentucky this week. The Attorney General is arguing that Bevin's board restructuring, well, restructuring, I guess, isn't really the best term, like abolishing
right.
and replacing the board at U of L was unconstitutional. If you'll remember, Franklin Circuit Court Judge Shepard said that Bevin could not abolish the board without a hearing, and Bevin appealed. So that's why it's at the Supreme Court. But there's an argument that this issue is now moot, as there was legislation passed this year that accounts for replacing the board.
Right.
Do you remember what mootness is?
You know what? This is one of the ones that stuck with me, but it basically means that whoever is suing, they no longer have like a leg to stand on. Pretty.
It
much.
Doesn't matter anymore because it's already been
decided in a different way.
Right.
Yeah.
So the 2017 General Assembly ratified Bevin's reorganization of the board by passing Senate Bill 12. They also passed a second law, Senate Bill 170, which sets out conditions for naming or removing trustees at all public universities, including a requirement that trustees appointed by the governor must be confirmed by the Senate. But one of the exceptions to mootness is capable of repetition yet evading review. And so the Attorney General is arguing that it's not only capable of repetition, he is repeating these kinds of actions over and over with the KSR board, workers' comp, etc. So
KRS. KSR is a different thing.
Right. Well, okay, I think of KSR also as the state reformatory. So
oh, okay.
So I get those mixed up a lot. KRS. And KRS is also the Kentucky Revised Statute. So there's lots of acronyms with those three letters. And then the second court case is about the education boards. So the attorney general has also sued the governor over the reorganization of several education boards. This suit was just filed in June of this year, so we haven't really talked about this one as much.
Okay.
And it's Andy Beshear's fourth suit against Bevin, and it's the third involving boards, basically. So this is different than the U of L case because university boards have a different statute.
Uh-huh.
This reorganization doesn't necessarily have the same requirements that a university reorganization would. So the Kentucky Education Association has joined Beshear in this suit.
And that's the union that that teachers are part of, right?
Right. And the law firm I actually clerked at during law school represents the Kentucky Education Association.
There you go.
So Bevin's attorney filed a motion to dismiss in this case, which Judge Wingate, also of the Franklin Circuit Court, converted to a motion for summary judgment.
What does that mean?
A motion for summary judgment is basically the party making the motion marshals all the evidence in its favor, compares it to the other sides, and then argues that there's no triable issues of fact. So basically, a judge can award summary judgment if the undisputed facts and the law make it clear that it would be impossible for the opposing party to prevail if the matter were to proceed to trial.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
Instead of a motion to dismiss, Judge Wingate said this is more proper for a motion for summary judgment, but the attorney general's office gets to respond and say you shouldn't grant summary judgment to the
right.
governor in
but
this case.
But if he does grant summary judgment, it doesn't necessarily mean that even if the case is dismissed,
summary
loss,
judgment
right?
would be a judgment on the merits.
Yeah, it'd be like a judgment.
It'd be a loss
yeah.
for the attorney general if they granted Matt Bevin's motion for summary judgment.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's what's going on in that case. They've got 20 days to respond to that motion, and then Judge Wingate will rule on it. So it may proceed, or he may grant the motion for summary judgment.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, geez, boards are crazy.
Right. There's more board. There's another board suit, but these are updates in two of them.
Yeah.
And I guess we will probably get a ruling on the Supreme Court one relatively soon.
Right. I mean, we've been talking about this story for a full year now. With the boards. So, you know.
Our very first episode was about the U of L board.
Yeah, and now it's at the Supreme Court and will be decided soon. All right, well, let's keep rolling with Jasmine and her wisdom.
Okay.
Matt Bevin had a Facebook Live video about pensions, right? So tell us
right.
a little bit
so
about
So I probably
what's going
have less wisdom about the pension crisis. Robert may have to fill in some things, or Chris, if you have anything to add to this. But PFM Consulting was hired by the state to make recommendations regarding Kentucky's pension crisis. To quickly summarize the pension crisis.
We have a show on this too.
We do. We have two major pension systems, the Kentucky Retiree System, KRS, and the Teacher Retiree System. And there's basically a major gap in what is paid into the system and what is owed. So if you go all the way back to episode 2, so we've been talking about this for a year as well, you can listen to Robert explain the pension crisis in greater detail.
I should do that. I forgot it mostly too.
Well, here we go. On Monday night, Matt Bevin did a Facebook Live video to explain the PFM recommendations and the potential changes to the pension systems that may be implemented in a special session. And it sounds like there will be a special session probably in October. And just a reminder, special sessions do cost the taxpayers money.
Yeah, so. I mean, we got to pay the legislators to do work, so.
Right. Also remember, right now these are just recommendations. They're not legislation, but I think that Republicans like these recommendations, so they could become legislation with their supermajority in the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So the recommendations were presented to the Public Pension Oversight Board and to the State Budget Director, John Shilton, who has said that painful changes are needed to fix the pension crisis.
Right.
So just looking over some of those changes, one of those would be to move all new public workers into a defined employer contribution system like a 401k instead of a defined benefits or hybrid cash balance plan of many new workers since 2014. So, Robert, can you explain the difference between those two?
Yeah, for
a little
sure.
Bit?
I mean, it is kind of self-explanatory, but the words are kind of in a weird order. So, like, defined benefit is you get told how much you're going to get at the end. So it's like your pension means it's a defined benefit because you're going to get out this much money every month for the rest of your life. Right. That's your pension. A defined contribution is when you start paying into it, it's defined how much the retirement system is going to pay in. So the interest rate can change over time, and sometimes more money is owed and you don't really know exactly how much you're going to have to pay out. But if it's a defined contribution system, you know exactly how much money you're going to have to pay in for that person. And then once they retire, that's all they get. So you get a defined contribution as opposed to a defined benefit. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And that's one of the big things. And this was a big change because for the longest time, many people in the state government, almost everybody in state government got a pension, which was a defined benefit. Now they took a big step in the other direction with these hybrid cash balance plans, which still have a lot of elements of defined benefit plans, which are more generous towards the worker. But moving to a 401k would be a huge step, maybe the longest step towards cutting benefits for retirees.
I'd say that's probably the most significant of all the proposed changes, but some of the others are raising the retirement age of current and new workers, removing the ability to put unused sick time towards their pension benefits, mm-hmm. eliminating any pension benefit payments for current retirees that resulted from cost of living adjustments granted between 1996 and 2012.
Wow, I did not know that.
Could you explain a little bit? So those are called COLAs. Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little bit about what that would mean?
Right. So like cost of living adjustments are, you know, over time, the cost of living is increasing. Sometimes that's due to inflation. Sometimes that's just due to the fact that, you know, it costs more to live in a certain place than it used to. So the pension board, and this is what actually the KRS does. Neil Ramsey, our friend who owned the house, is the chair over there. But the KRS board, one of the things that they do is define when pensioners would receive a cost of living adjustment, which would mean that they would get more money in their defined benefit contribution or in their defined benefit pension, which would result in them taking more money away. Removing the COLAs is like legitimately just cutting benefits.
Right.
And removing future COLAs is basically just, you know, saying here's the money that you're going to get forever, and if inflation gets out of control, that's too bad for you.
The proposed change would be that future COLAs would be suspended for teachers until the plan reached a funding level of 90%, while new teachers would now be eligible for Social Security along with a 401k type plan, but no longer having their defined benefit.
Which would basically be like me, who works in the private sector.
Right.
Like I'm eligible for Social Security and have a 401k. So that would basically mean, or you're like a private worker. When it used to be, you know, one of the trade-offs for working in the public sector was, you know, you don't get paid a lot now, but the benefits are really nice and you get a pension. That would mean no more of that.
Right. And then a couple other changes. Workers in hazardous jobs wouldn't be able to retire after 25 years of service, but they'd have to wait until age 60 if they didn't want their benefits significantly cut. So that if they retired early, they would not get their full benefits. And then employees could also take a buyout offer.
Being able to retire after 25 years, that's significantly shorter. I think teachers have to work for like 35 or 37. I'm not sure the amount, but it's substantially more than 25 hazardous workers, which are, you know, people like cops and state police and different people that work in more dangerous jobs. They have a shorter period that they have to work, and then they can retire with full benefits. That would go away, it looks like. The buyout offer is something that I've heard that a lot of people are very worried that if these go into effect, that a lot of workers may just retire and take the buyout rather than put themselves up for these major changes, which would likely cut their benefits.
Right. And some Democrats have suggested the idea of issuing pension obligation bonds, but PMF was against this and they said it would be too risky. And another idea that was shot down by PMF was making the county retirement systems independent of the state system. PMF said that this would create unnecessary administrative costs. And of course, tax reform was also dismissed and not really.
Yeah.
A part of that plan.
The bonds was Greg Stumbo's big idea last year, or I guess not last year, the last time he was in the legislature, which I guess was 2 years ago.
Right.
It didn't pass, and it looks like
part of what mm-hmm. could pass in this session either. So the state budget director, John Chilton, said without these changes, an extra $1 billion would be needed in the next fiscal year to make the pension contributions, which would mean that the state agency cuts by 9% in the current budget ending next summer, would then have to be cut by 34% in the next two-year budget. So if the state also chose to cut K through 12 education, those agencies would only be cut by 16%. But those are huge cuts that would need to be made if we didn't make these changes, says the state budget director.
And also, that's after making substantial cuts in the last budget and the budgets before. We've already taken several cuts over a long right. period of time. This would be even deeper cuts after deep cuts. And another thing that I have read is that Governor Bevin's assumptions about how much money is necessary are based on a number which people are thinking is significantly more pessimistic than the reality. And that's not to say that we haven't been overly optimistic in the past, but it's almost like we've swung too far the other direction with the assumptions that they're making and how much money that they're going to need. So that's a lot of math and a lot of numbers. but yeah, that's something that to be aware of.
Right. So that's kind of, those are the recommendations and the changes that were made in this report by the consulting business that was contracted by the state. Governor Bevin took to Facebook Live for
his
a pension
format.
Chat, his favorite form of media. He said that the government would not pursue all of the recommendations made, but he did praise the report for highlighting how bad the issue is. He also said that any legislation that is passed would not have an emergency clause. So that means it wouldn't go into effect immediately. So that means that workers would have an opportunity to make decisions about their future as state workers. So who's mad? Teachers are really mad. Matt Bevin kind of blamed them and said that if they retire now to protect their benefits, then they shouldn't be in the classroom.
Oof.
So that's a little harsh. JCPS board chairman Brady said that local school districts would have to find the funds needed to set up teachers for Social Security on top of losing funds from charter schools.
Right.
So, and of course, obviously these changes would also make it more difficult than it already is to recruit quality teachers. Mm-hmm. Bevin also led off the chat by talking about an email where a teacher cursed at him.
Did you watch that part?
I didn't actually watch it. Okay. I saw like a still shot of him pointing at, he had like a little TV set up okay. where he like showed the email.
It was hilarious because what he did was he led off by saying, this person did a bad job. And this person did a good job. And I'm like, man, you're talking to teachers. They know that trick. In fact, they do that trick in their classrooms every single day. Like, so I don't know. I don't think that anybody was fooled. He needed to do a better job of reading the room in there. And I looked at everybody that was commenting on the Facebook Live video, which I did read. You know how they have like your friends' comments first?
Right.
Everybody that I saw that had made a comment was a teacher. It does seem like you're right that teachers were the people who were the most heated. Like basically every teacher I know was in there like, this is bad, Matt Bevin. So
yeah.
Granted, I'm friends with liberal teachers, but you know, that is true.
Yeah. So he definitely called out teachers and said if they want to retire, they shouldn't even be doing it anyways. But also all state workers are kind of mad. There's a worry that current state workers could rush to retirement or that they would file lawsuits based on violating the contract that they were promised. And the report mm-hmm. from PMF didn't even address what contract rights workers may have. So that could definitely be a potential issue.
Right.
The whole state house is meeting about the issue. Speaker Jeff Hoover called for a closed session to prevent grandstanding,
Probably a good idea.
Probably a good idea. Yeah. I agree. So those are the proposed recommendations.
I did see also there was a write-up of a hearing about this where the state budget director said they weren't too worried about people rushing to retirement if these were passed. And apparently everybody, including the state police officers that were guarding the rooms,
right,
laughing.
They laughed. Yeah, so yeah, so maybe there is a worry there. Maybe people are upset about this, but it sounds like there will be a special session of the General Assembly in October and legislation will likely be passed.
All right. Jasmine, thank you for all that work. That was a lot of information you brought to us. Two stories in a row and all kinds of good information. Jasmine, we have talked about many, many things on this story in our first year, and we needed to spend some time catching up on other things.
Right. We do these big stories. We're like, hey, we'll update you. And then we kind of don't sometimes.
We're going to take care of that.
So that's what we're doing.
We're going to take care of that right now. Okay, so friend of the pod, Senator Whitney Westerfield, who we had on the show.
We did.
He was great. He talked to us about criminal justice reform. He announced recently that he is going to be running for attorney general again. He's a Republican, and now Andy Beshear has to decide if he's going to run for attorney general again. He is not term limited. He's only in his first term. So he can either run for attorney general again, or many people have suggested he might challenge Matt Bevin for governor himself. Or he could run for something else. Who knows?
And Whitney Westerfield lost the attorney general race to Andy Beshear by a pretty narrow margin.
Yeah, it's like 5,000 votes or something. Yes. Very small. So, yeah, I think it was like 49.5% to 50.5%, which was shocking because he was a first-term state senator in his 30s, and Andy Beshear was the son of the governor. So, all right, that's the first thing we wanted to catch you up on. The second is that the city of Louisville has decided to spend $8,200 to clean up the paint on the controversial John Castleman statue. That work is already going on. Representative Attica Scott, another friend of the pod, hopefully, she wondered on Facebook if that money shouldn't have been spent for public work projects in the West End. She was kind of like, well, there was like a picture of some broken sidewalks, and she was like, yeah, we could find $8,200 to clean up a statue of a Confederate general. We got broken sidewalks in the West End. That's not right. So,
and I think she makes a really good point. Yeah. Also, $8,200 sounds pretty expensive to...
Yeah, apparently. Apparently they tried a lot of other things, and the paint was pretty serious. So I went over and looked at it. It did look pretty well. It looked pretty well painted. The next thing to talk about: Senator Dennis Parrott of E-Town is replacing Senator Julian Carroll as the minority whip. If you'll remember, Senator Julian Carroll was caught up in a scandal where he asked a man for sexual favors and may have done other more inappropriate things. Senator Parrott is, according to the W nominate scores from the 2016 session, the most conservative Democrat in the Kentucky Senate, but he is still significantly more liberal than the most conservative Republican. These decisions about
the
who
most
goes,
liberal Republican?
Yeah. That's what, did I say most conservative? Yeah. Well, he's significantly more liberal than even the most liberal Republican.
Okay.
There you go. Okay.
Got it.
So, Senator Parrott, the leadership is more about relationships and determining what the caucus is going to do rather than, you know, deciding what to oppose, because basically everybody who's a Democrat is going to oppose everything that Republicans put forth. So, you know, I don't know if ideology is as important in these leadership positions as relationships, but we'll see. Obviously, you know, more progressive people wish a more progressive person was in that position, but we'll see how Senator Parrott does. Okay, more U of L stuff. James Ramsey's computer was erased when he left his job at the University of Louisville in the U of L Foundation. Do you remember all that?
Yep, sounds sketchy.
It was very sketchy. There was all these audits, and they had all these crazy emails about people covering stuff up. And, you know, there was all these things like, we need to hide this information in shell companies to keep it from freedom of information and requests and stuff like that. But none of the emails were on James Ramsey's hard drive because his hard drive was erased. The University of Louisville confirmed that the Attorney General's office has opened a criminal investigation into the erasure of James Ramsey's hard drive.
So I think none of this is surprising at all after hearing the results of the audit.
Yeah, not at all. I don't know. I don't know who's going to be caught up into it. There's like IT people, perhaps the IT person who might be caught up into it was the son of the longtime, you know, assistant to James Ramsey who got fired after all of this. It's quite a mess over there still. Okay, the Attorney General has ruled that the Jefferson County Board of Assessment Appeals did not violate open records laws when they refused to let the media tour Matt Bevin's house. Do you remember this one?
I do. It was a very recent story.
Yeah, so Matt Bevin, the whole house issue, Tom Loftus showed up to go on the tour of the house with the Board of Assessment Adjustment or whatever they are, the JCBOAA. He said it was an open record. They were a public group, and they're subject to open records, and it was a meeting that they were having, even if the meeting was at Matt Bevin's house. Matt Bevin said, no, you can't do that, and the BOAA said, no, you can't do that. They took them to court, but they decided, no, yeah, that's right. You can't just tour people's houses.
Right. And I think what the Attorney General opinion actually said is that there was insufficient evidence to determine that they violated it.
Right.
And Attorney General opinions are persuasive authority. So, you know, another issue could come up like this and maybe, you know, a different ruling.
Jasmine, bring in the lawyer knowledge. Yeah, I guess it wasn't a judge. It was just an Attorney General opinion. So, yeah, that's not a judge. All right. And the last update to have for you guys. The Bevin administration has overruled the state legislature, and U of L will be allowed to spend more of its own budget on outside attorneys. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when the U of L went to the state legislature and said, we'd like to spend more than the money we had budgeted on outside attorneys. And they thought it was just going to kind of be a rubber stamp. And the legislature said, no, you can't. You've already spent too much money on outside attorneys. I didn't realize this when I said this story. So just as a clarification, U of L has to go to the state government to talk about spending even their own money that they've raised through tuition fees and whatever else. The state legislature has control over that. So they were basically just asking to spend their own money on outside attorneys. And the state legislature said no. So I had said at the time that that was kind of egregious and they needed to spend the money to figure out what was going on. It feels even more egregious now that I know that they are trying to spend their own money. So, you know, good on you, Governor Bevin's administration, for overruling the legislature on that issue. All right. That wraps it up for today. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. They can like our Facebook page. Robert posts our show notes on Medium, and you can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice.
All right. Thank you guys very much, and we will see you next week.